guys, welcome to our first episode of the Game Diaries. Michelle, hello.
Hi, I'm so excited. I can't believe it's actually happening. I feel like we've been waiting for months to like put this out. We actually have been waiting for months.
But the good news is that if we've been waiting months and we still like the idea, we know it's a good one, right? Because we didn't rush it or anything. We still believe in it.
Maybe we should have done this.
We would have stopped this long time ago. Okay, so we're being joined from people all across the world, I hope, for this episode, because we're kicking the Game Diaries in the best way as possible, as natural as possible. So we're just going to jump in right away. What is the Game Diaries for you, Michelle?
The Game Diaries is a collective journal for people in the video game community that wants to talk about how video games have affected their life. I mean, all of these, there's so many different stories, like from, you know, huge famous game developers to like, you know, your guildies in World of Warcraft or people you play CSGO with. Like, there are people who have been affected by games all over this world. And I just am excited to be able to like tell those stories and share them with other people. Like, that's what the gaming community is about, you know?
I couldn't have said better. And I think that too often we talk about video games in a light that honestly is not doing it justice. We barely ever talk about the video game wins, the greatest moment, the emotional moment. And I kind of want to take pauses and celebrate it with you, Michelle.
I agree. Well, and like so much, you know, of the media kind of tends to focus on the negative aspects, which sometimes it's deserved. But
yeah.
I think it overshadows like the healing benefits and the good vibes that video games often give off. So this will be, we did record this a few months ago. But we wanted to give it to you guys exactly the way we recorded it so that you can just have it, especially because the story that we're covering is about the very first video game tournament ever, which was 40 years ago this month in October. It happened 40 years ago.
Yeah, crazy. It's actually pretty crazy. I wasn't born 40 years ago. This is the first, the first poke and hopefully the last one. Well,
some of us were, Stephanie. Some of us were okay, alive. Okay.
You actually look younger than me, so don't worry about it. like you mentioned, but for those at home, I just want to reiterate how, you know, we recorded that pilot to kind of flesh out how we should do the episodes and how we could really bring that stories and these stories to light. And we liked it so much that we just decided for that pilot to be our episode number one. So you'll see it's as natural as it can be. And we're just going to grow and get it better and better as time goes. Okay.
And normally we will be reading your listener submitted stories.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
At the front of the episode. This, because we had a pilot, we didn't have a story to read yet, but normally we would be having some chit chat, read one of our listener stories, and then go into one of the stories that we wrote for you guys. So we really hope you guys enjoy it. Let us know what you think. And if you have a listener story that you want to submit, you can go to thegamediaries.com and, you know, and write it out for us.
Yay. Let's jump right into it. This is perfect. This is perfect, Michelle. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing really good. I'm doing great. I've got my Lacroix. Is that how you say it? Oh God, you say it fancy.
Lacroix. It's like croissant, but you don't pronounce the X. So Lacroix.
The croix. I've only had one like two times in my life. So my husband like put a little extra agave syrup in it and like souped it up for me.
It looks.
So I'm excited.
Very cute. Is that the Oculus glass that we got together?
Oh my God! It is.
Oh my God! What is that coincidence?
Back. Wow.
Get me the Oculus glass.
I can't believe that. That's so funny.
Too. I love that glass.
It's a great glass. Yeah. That's so funny. I still haven't set up my Oculus now that we moved. I haven't set it up yet. I need to do that.
It took me so long to set it up that when we eventually set it up, it was the wired version and my boyfriend was just like, I'm too cool to use the wire version. I'm buying the wireless. And then so we kind of never use
it. So it's just sitting there?
Yeah, and now he uses the wireless. And
did you win that tournament?
No, I did bad. I'm pretty much sure you beat me. And no,
I got like fourth.
I was so unfocused. I was competing right that weekend in Connecticut.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you were doing an actual competition.
Yes. So I was just like kind of zooming in and out, and I frankly didn't practice enough. And it's all about practicing. If you don't practice, you don't win.
It's very, very, very true. That's for sure. Have you been playing? What have you been playing this week?
Oh my God. Have you played this new game, The Fall Guy?
No, but I've seen like 100 videos about it now. Like, is it fun?
It is so fun. This is the best party game. And it's kind of a party game for online, which usually you like play a couch party game online and it's missing that feeling. This one is a definite party game with your friends online. Because sometimes you're against each other. And as soon as like there's team stuff, you're together. For those who don't know anything, it's literally just little derpy characters. And you got to go from A to B, point A to point B. And whoever doesn't make it there kind of gets eliminated. You start with like 50 people or 60 people. And at the end, you have a king of the hill kind of thing.
That's my kind of battle royale. I'm much more into that than like having to like scope and, you know, snipe anybody. I can't do that.
And they're
so derpy.
These little characters are so cute. You can play like a soda can or
do you know who developed it?
Honestly, I've never heard of them before. But I really like the way they've handled the whole launch. The hype on Twitch and everything. It's been good.
It's been really cute. Yeah, I saw it. The download played it, that new Venn network started it out. And so I watched some of that and was like, this looks like a good game. So yeah, I'm definitely into doing it.
Jump in, jump out. I'm usually overwhelmed when I have to like try a new multiplayer game with people. I'm like, I need to try it alone, like without anyone, to make sure I don't look like a fool. Like, don't talk to me. And this one, I was just like, okay, let's give it a shot. Like, join a group, play, and then like move. Like, I didn't even have to see the controls or anything. It was very intuitive. So those are my type of games.
Yeah. I like little party games.
Yeah, and it looks like they have a pretty big development setup going on. They have like seasons and stuff. Should be good.
Well, it's definitely something I'll download this week. I'll check it out for sure.
Have you played it in game this week?
I just started playing the new Hearthstone expansion.
Oh, you
Skullomance.
You're super into Hearthstone still? That's so cool.
I love Hearthstone. I think it's so fun. It's like I will play it at night when we're watching a movie or something and I'm like half caring about the movie and I'll just start, you know, climbing the ladder. And I'll just
tablet,
play.
Your phone?
Yeah. No, just on my iPad. I mean, my iPad is basically just a Hearthstone machine.
It's
all it is. Like, I like do some like drawing with Procreate on it and then I just play Hearthstone. So it's a very expensive Hearthstone machine.
Have you tried TFT on your tablet?
No, I have not yet. Okay. Have you done it on tablet?
I've tried on my phone. It was a little small, but it was okay. But I think a tablet is probably the perfect size. So
maybe I'll switch it up a little bit.
Yeah.
maybe
like another type of slogan.
I don't know if the iPad can handle it at this point. It's like a little grandma right now. She's just like, I can just take Hearthstone and that's about it. So yeah. But I get excited when the new expansion comes out because, you know, I buy like, you know, all the card decks and then I can just like burst them open and get like super excited about what I get and disenchant. And it's a very exciting hour.
I kind of wish I never got out of it because it feels like the step is too high. You know, so many expansions and packs that I haven't seen.
That's true. I mean, I guess if you don't keep up, but if you, you know, I mean, that's part of it. Like you drop like $20 and you can get, you know, a bunch of packs to open. You're pretty much caught up. I mean,
it won't take too long.
They give you little quests and stuff and then they'll like gift you packs or, you know, you can play in the arena or the battlegrounds and get dust so you can make cards and stuff and craft them. But I don't know. I love Hearthstone.
There's so many good bedtime games now. Honestly, I get more on my morning routine and my bedtime routine than any time of the day. I just start my mobile games and I take out my little Switch, like do a little bit in Animal Crossing. And then,
yes.
Okay, I can still go to bed, you know, or okay, I can jump in the shower and start the day.
Animal Crossing. I haven't logged into Animal Crossing for like a month, and I bet you like half my villagers are pissed off. You've been playing?
Yeah. I think the only thing they tell you is like, oh, I haven't seen you in a little bit. They don't want you to like...
They're really passive aggressive. They're really rude. They're like, oh, you decided to come back. You're like, excuse me, jerk. Like, and then sometimes they'll move. I remember on the 3DS one, I had Stitches. He was like my favorite little bear guy.
He's so cute.
He's so cute. And yeah. When I logged back in after like probably a year, I checked my mail and I had a little framed photo that Stitches sent me. And I was like, oh, and I like put it on my desk in my house. Mm-hmm. And then I went to go like see Stitches and he'd moved. So,
oh, what the hell? They on the 3DS, they could move without talking.
Yes.
To you?
See, he was just out. And he was gone. Okay, he's like,
okay, not the Switch version. They ask you every time. They're like, I think I want to go on an adventure. And every time I'm like, no, B.
They don't just randomly move out one day.
No, they don't. They ask you every time.
What if you like time travel though?
Oh, I don't time travel. So
never?
Never. I haven't time traveled once.
Never?
Never. I think it would be too overwhelming. As soon as I start doing it, then I'll be like, oh, I could just time travel tomorrow and fix this, right?
So yeah, you can.
That's too
you
much.
Can. I'll be like, I get impatient. I'm like, I need this bridge built now and I'm not waiting. So just like time travel to the next day, it's built, bounce back to the day before. So I just do it till it'll be like, it's finished and then go back. Cause when I get in that planning mode and I want to like, you know, plant my flowers, plant my trees and get it all like nice. I need the construction speed. I hate how you can only do like one construction at a time. I wish you could do a mode where just be like, open it up and just let me do whatever. It's not like it's a competitive game. Nintendo acts like it's the most competitive game in the world and you can't, you're not allowed to do more than one public feature a day. And it's like, guys.
I get it. And I think that I would be 60, 70% on your side, but I'm so overwhelmed with life that sometimes I'm like, okay, I'll wait tomorrow. True. To get the second bridge in. But I think I get it. I think for most people, it's your vision is best.
I don't know. I think
my
it's
vision
like,
is like, please don't let me play too much.
Mine is like vision. Based in impatience and just being a petulant brat where I'm like, I want it now. I want it now, Stephanie.
You know what I want now?
What?
Your story.
You want my story?
Hell yeah.
Oh my gosh. I'm actually really excited about this one. I did so much work on this story. It's actually really exciting. So, okay, we can do it. It's some pressure, but let's do it.
It's a lot of pressure because...
It's a lot of pressure.
You're the one that starts and I have to just listen and be happy about everything you just did. So it's all on you, Michelle.
Here we go. All right. Well, my story, it's about the very first esports champion.
Okay.
Do you know who the very first esports champion was or what game it was or what year it was? Do you know, being that you are an esports champion, do you know anything about the very first person who ever won an esports championship?
So I'm so embarrassed right now because I don't know. And on top of that, I feel I should have known and I should have done research at some point in my 17 years of esports. I should have been like, I wonder who, because I'm super, super curious.
But
I think
to be
would
fair,
be Tetris, something in Tetris. Because I feel
close.
There was, okay, not Tetris.
I mean, it was before that, but
before
Tetris, there was a championship early on. So I mean, the thing is, like, a lot of this stuff isn't documented very well. It's all over the place. I don't have, like, a tablet to read this on, so I'm just going to be reading it from my screen.
Okay.
So let me, I'll sit on my glasses.
No, your tablet isn't for that anyway. It's for Hearthstone.
Your tablet is only a Hearthstone machine. That's all it's for. That is it.
Okay, so it's not Tetris. All right.
All right. Well, the 40th anniversary is coming up this October, actually. So I thought it might be kind of cool for us to know a little bit more about who paved the way for this massive industry that we call esports. So there's a lot of info. It's all over the place. Yeah, 40 years. 40. It happened in October of 1980.
Were you born?
I was born. I was born in 1978, girl. That's
no
damn right.
Way. You were born in the 70s. That's awesome.
Isn't that cool?
Thanks. It is really cool. It is really cool. I was born in the 80s.
Me and my grandma iPad.
Yeah. And I feel like I'm already a grandma. So we're like grandma sisters.
Little gaming grandmas. Yes. That's what we are. Well, there's a ton of information about the very first gaming tournament all over the place. Like, it's not all kind of in one place, because this did happen in 1980, where we didn't really have the internet in the form that it is. So it's everywhere. So I had to dig, but I'm going to be referencing material from the Atari Compendium, who had an interview with the winner, and various newspaper clippings, including the New York Times archives from 1980, Rolling Stone, Creative Computing, interviews on Gamma Sutra, some wikis, archive posts on Reddit's R Retro Gaming and R History Porn, the Internet Wayback Machine. Luckily,
I love that one.
Luckily, cache tons of info that would otherwise be lost forever. And some YouTube channels who had some fantastic interviews with the winner in more recent years, including a channel called The Pioneers of Esports, as well as personal.
There's a channel like that?
There is. They're small. They don't have a ton of views, but I really respect what they're doing, that they're trying to like get an oral history from a lot of the people who started esports. And also from the personal blog and website of the winner. So in order to talk about the first champion story,
okay, you're sitting
in. We first have to establish what the first esports tournament actually was. So we have to get a couple little technicalities out of the way here.
Yeah.
All right. So technically speaking, in 1972, the very first closed gaming tournament was held for the very second video game ever created, called Space War. A writer for Rolling Stone magazine convinced the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab to shut down for one night for the first intergalactic space war Olympics.
No way they called it that.
They did.
That is amazing.
They totally called it that. But the game wasn't commercially available, and there were very few people who were even able to run it, because the first mainframe computer that it ran on, called the PDP-1, and it had like several variations after that, It was a little expensive for the time.
What, like, you're gonna tell me like something like 10
I mean,
grand?
I mean, it was. I mean, close. It was 120,000.
Oh my god! In the 70s, so that's probably like millions now. Holy moly! Yeah,
exactly. In today's dollars, it actually is just a little bit more than $1 million.
Oh wow!
So this first game was. Not very many people could even play it. Only like secure military locations and like research labs even had it installed on a computer. And for the most part, only a few dozen people, like mostly researchers, ever even had the opportunity to play Space War. So while the first intergalactic Space War Olympics was technically the first esports tournament, and at some point we will totally 100% share the full story on this podcast, it was considered closed entry. And only students and researchers at Stanford were invited to watch or play. Stanford grad student Bruce Baumgart took down his fellow classmates and got a one-year subscription to Rolling Stone magazine as his prize.
Oh, so is that the first winner?
That's not. That okay. is not going to be. That's the technicality. So that was like a closed tournament on a $1 million computer on a game that like nobody played. So it was
so
just
it
like.
Count.
Kids at Stanford that were able to play it. Nobody else. So technicalities out of the way, the story I'm sharing is about the first large-scale open entry esports tournament in October of 1980, which is 40 years ago this year. I feel like we should do something to celebrate. You know? Like, can we like redo this?
I always thought the beginning of esports was like in the 98, you know? 99, and then you're telling me it's in
1980, before you were born.
Yeah,
before your birth, and that's 2 years crazy. Into my birth. So Atari held the Atari 2600 Space Invaders tournament, and it attracted more than 100,000 participants across the United States. Compared to the complexity of today's titles, it might seem kind of silly for us to think about Space Invaders as an esport, but this little fixed shooter was enormously popular. It was released in 1978, the greatest year ever, and Space Invaders was created by a Japanese video game developer named Tomohiro Nishikaru.
They have such a cool name, right? Yeah, it is.
Who created the game all by himself like a baller. He did the development, design, artwork, sounds, and he even engineered the game's hardware by putting together a microcomputer from scratch. So okay. He did the whole thing on his own. And although the little 8-bit Space Invader, this guy, even though the little Space Invader has kind of become synonymous with video games, even as like the little purple emoji in our phones.
That's true.
Nishikaru originally, Like it's like there. So he originally planned to use airplanes as the bad guys, but he couldn't get them to run smoothly on the screen. So his second choice was using humans, but the Taito Corp, who he was working under, was like, no. And he kind of thought like, yeah, I guess that's immoral. We can't really shoot people, you know, which is hilarious.
2020.
Like, we can't shoot people. Yeah. That would be wrong. So they're like, how is he going to do it? So he was inspired by H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds and Star Wars, which had just come out in 1977. And they were, you know, obviously promoting it right before then. And the Space Invader was born. So the game hit arcades in 1978, greatest year ever, and became a commercial success, making it not only the best-selling video game, but the highest-grossing entertainment product of all time. And remember, Star Wars had just come out in 1977 and was the highest-grossing film of all time with $486 million. But by the time of this tournament in 1980, Space Invaders had grossed nearly $1 billion in quarters.
Wait, what?
Just people just plugging them into the machine.
I had no idea they made that much money out of like arcade machines. Oh yeah.
They actually crashed like the Bank of Japan because they didn't have enough yen. That was like their quarter to put into the machine. And they had to up their production just because of this video game. Like, how insane is that?
And what? How come we don't know these things?
And in just for 2020 inflation, that's around $3.5 billion that this game made in like the 2 years it was out. So everyone was playing this game, pretty much everybody. Did you ever play Space Invaders like growing up?
Not growing up, but I kind of had a moment of retro games in my life where I bought back a bunch of old school consoles that I never had because I was born later than their release. So like Atari, what's it called again?
Coleco?
Yeah, that's Coleco. You know, a bunch of old stuff. And actually, do I have them here? I think they're in a box because I don't want to break them, but I should probably put them like right behind me as well.
Just have like a little display.
Yeah, of my old school stuff.
Mine are all, you can't see it, but I have like a little history museum over there of like consoles I owned because, you know, 1978.
Yes.
But like growing up, my best friend, Jan Michael, his parents owned a Space Invaders cabinet.
And
it was down in his basement and we didn't need quarters for it. You could just like pop it open and trigger the little mechanism for the quarters and add a bunch of lives onto the machine. So we would play Space Invaders all day, every day in like the early 80s, like all the time.
That was a great reward mechanism for parents, right? We'll give you a quarter to play if you do your bedroom. Yeah.
Instead, we're just like jacked it open and we're like, we're just going to make it do as many as we want.
Yeah.
Just because we're brats. So in 1980, the Atari 2600 licensed the game. They said Space Invaders is a hit. We're going to take it. And it quadrupled the sales of the video game console itself, making it the first killer app, kind of like the Super Mario Brothers game for the NES or Halo for Xbox. People bought the Atari just for Space Invaders, and it sold over 2 million cartridges in 1980 alone. Yeah.
How many of my friends that are non-gamers bought the Switch for Animal Crossing?
Right?
I, yep. I would have probably bought it too. Yep.
a killer app. Yeah, I mean, it's considered that. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. The game was far more interactive to the player than anything that ever come before it. Enemies shot back. You could take cover. These were things that never happened before, because all they had before this was like table tennis, like a Pong kind of game. Yeah. And many developers of today actually cite Space Invaders as inspiration for their work, kind of like the Beatles of gaming. Like mm-hmm. Deus Ex creator Warren Spector says, Space Invaders and games like it represent the roots of everything we see today in games. It represents the birth of a new art form, one that literally changed the world. Space Invaders is important as a historical artifact, no less than the silent film of the early 20th century or early printed books. So probably most importantly, though, for esports and competition, it was the first video game to introduce leaderboards. Not only getting the high score, but saving that high score with your own three little initials for bragging rights at arcades across the world. So getting a high score in Space Invaders was suddenly like a big fucking deal. And reportedly, some kids were plugging like $80 a night into this thing and like just to get their initials on the screen. Yeah. Can you imagine, like, that's quarters. That's like 320 quarters that you're just rolling around with. Like, did they just keep changing it out at the machine, or like
probably, right?
Just like had it in a cup, you know? Like we used to walk around like at Chuck E. Cheese. Yeah, totally.
You know, I used to rent the N64 with the game Wave Race every couple of weekends because we didn't have it at home, and I used to just try to have the highest score and put my name in it so that when people would rent it, they would need to beat me. Like,
yes. Yes.
No, I totally get it.
It was just like that feeling like, yeah, I did it, you know?
Yep.
And Atari, they saw this high score phenomenon and they capitalized. They were like, we are going to announce the first ever open entry video game competition, the Atari 2600 Space Invaders Tournament. And they didn't have, you know, the accessible internet that we have today. So they got the word out at the start of 1980 through mailings and posters around towns. And the Atari spokeswoman at the time, Ginny Youngke, says the response was still not to be believed. They had five regional contests, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Fort Worth, Chicago, and New York City, where the finals were also held. Now, in my research, pretty mm-hmm. much every publication says over 10,000 people entered the tournament, but the players themselves remember it much differently. The first regional was held in San Francisco, where Atari is located, and that regional alone attracted more than 25,000 competitors, and Atari was overwhelmed because they only had like a dozen kiosks set up. They just straight up were not imagining people were going to enter, so they were using like their trade show setups, you know? They're just like, here we go, come play. They didn't expect 25,000 kids to come.
What a mess.
Yes, exactly. And that's how it's described. A mess. Like the you know, the employees are like running around with like chickens with their heads cut off and like dealing with kids in lines, you know?
It's like being America's Next Idol or whatever you guys call that show. Like without any control, like without any lines, any number, you're just like there. The people, like, we expected five people to come here and sing, and now we have like 3 days of people lined up outside.
Yeah, wow. And exactly like that. And honestly, this was a marketing budget. They were just trying to market the 2600. Like that's why they called it the Atari 2600 tournament, because this was their marketing budget. So they were like, all right, Los Angeles is our second regional. We got to up the ante here. So they knew they had to increase their staff and resources. So they did, but then 40,000 people showed up in Los Angeles. So even more.
They doubled up. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're just like, oh shit. Then in Chicago and Fort Worth, they saw around 40 to 50,000, and New York City attracted around 60,000. Kids were driving in from all over the region, like just to participate, just to hope to get in. And if you see photos of the tournament online, the main one that gets shared all the time, I actually shared it with you on Instagram earlier in the week. You'll see it's got like a bunch of dudes like sitting in a row. And they're all in front of like these boxy like TV screens with like an audience looking on in the background. That wasn't from the finals. That was actually a photo taken at the New York regionals.
So look at it again.
It's a cool photo.
Oh, like, no, it's gone because Instagram, it was a story from someone else.
Okay. Instagram. Yeah. I have it. But if you look it up, even if you just Google it, it's pretty much the only photo that shows up anyway, unless you like really do some hardcore digging like I did and I've found like actual photos. But that is of the New York City tournament. It was at a shopping mall. They moved it to a shopping mall in New York City. And the winner of the regional was a 14-year-old kid named Frank Tetreault Jr., who scored 110,125 points in a game that lasted over an hour. And he was the highest score going into the finals. So
there's a big loophole in their game is that you can play infinitely. Like, so that's why it takes forever.
Yeah. And that's going to come into play here, Steph. You haven't like, this is so funny. Like, this is, I couldn't believe, my mind was blown when I was reading this. All right.
Okay.
So Frank Tetreault Jr., he's like number one going into the finals. Like if you were in Vegas, you would be betting on Frank Tetreault Jr., 14-year-old from New York. Chicago regionals went to a 15-year-old kid named Stephen Marmel, who had 76,220 points. Fort Worth went to Robert Merrick, who got 72,570. San Fran went to Hin Ying, who was 16 years old and got 64,185. And last, but certainly not least, coming in second in regional scoring was a 16-year-old transgender female, Becky Heineman of Los Angeles, California, with 83,475 points.
Hold on. So only one person from each region?
Only one person. Finals? Yep. Only one person.
We're all rooting for Becky in this story.
We are rooting for Becky. We are rooting for Becky. And I had the opportunity to meet Becky and her wife Janelle in at PAX Prime in 2014 in Seattle for a dinner at Gearbox Software. I ended up at the end of the table with them and I was blown away hearing her stories and learning about her life, because for the most of our conversation, my mouth was just agape and just in awe and wonder, trying to figure out how I've never heard of her before. Like her story in gaming, we will get there. All right. So when listening to Rebecca speak about herself as a teenager, she was suffering from very low self-esteem, which unfortunately was a byproduct of the way her parents treated her. And hearing her describe it, she had a really rough childhood. It was really bad. Although she didn't get into specifics about what happened, by 14 years old, she had dropped out of school. She was homeless for a short time, and she even lived behind a dumpster. She was flat broke. She lied about her age to get jobs at a gas station and a warehouse at JCPenney. She said that she had a young life that she wouldn't wish on anyone, calling it, quote, a very bad situation. But she was enamored with the emerging technology of computers and games, which, and I'm projecting here, but I would imagine provided a sense of escape and a sense of control in such a young and turbulent time in her life.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so living behind a dumpster, really not having any money at all, very confused and tortured young transgender girl. And one day she saw an ad in the Penny Saver, which was, to explain to the kids out there, the Penny Saver was a newspaper of the era that listed things for sale, kind of like Analog's Craigslist.
Okay. I thought it was a link to JCPenney or
because of the JCPenney, because of the Penny Saver.
Okay, Penny Saver is, okay.
This is like a for sale newspaper kind of thing. Yeah. And she was looking through it and there was a brand new Apple II computer listed for $600, which was super cheap at the time because it originally retailed anywhere between like $1,300 and $2,600, depending on how much RAM it had. Which by the way, wasn't much, like, yeah. Like it was like four RAM, you know, just like nothing, you know? And that was like around $4,000 to $5,000 in like today's dollars. So $600, she's like, oh wow, I need this. And, she kind of wondered if maybe it had been stolen because it was brand new. It was not used. And that was like virtually unheard of. So luckily she'd saved up enough money from her jobs to afford it. And she had recently somewhat reconciled with her mother enough to be able to move back in. So she did have a room to put it in. So one night, after calling the guy up, speaking to him on the phone, she got on her bicycle, drove over to his house, picked the thing up in a box, and although it took her hours, somehow carried it home with her on the bike. Was just like commitment, you know? She's like, I need this. I love that. I was like, this girl is amazing.
I love it, but at the same time, I can't help to think, like, wasn't there buses then? Like, wasn't there like any other solution?
I think she scrounged up every last thing she had just to have it, you know? Okay. And also she did say she went late at night to go pick it up because part of this was sneaking around. And she did say it was like a really creepy night of her life, like trying to get back with this computer on her bike. Like I can just see the image, you know, like,
don't steal my computer. Don't get attached.
Yeah. Like, you know, so using a little TV set as a monitor, she set up her Apple II with a dream of learning how to program. She had a little cassette player to record and store her files and soon saved up enough money to buy a modem. And then she started BBSing. And for the non-programmers and hackers out there, BBS stands for Bulletin Board Service. Think of this like the early World Wide Web or like social networks. BBS meant a computer server running software that allowed her connect to the system using a terminal program. And once logged in, she could perform functions like uploading and downloading software and data, reading news and bulletins, and exchanging messages with other users through the public message boards or even direct chatting. So Rebecca was plugged in via modem to a whole new world. And through this, she found schematics for her computer, the Apple II. And she loved it. She spent hours reading and learning, claiming she just ate it up. She loved it. And in 1979, someone shared with her the pinout for an Atari 2600 game cartridge called Combat.
Oh my God, you have it.
Which I have. Combat. So she got the pinout for it and somehow figured out how to hack it even further by combining the schematics for an Apple II ROM card by doing some hacker stuff that frankly just like melts my brain. But by doing this, she was able to Frankenstein reverse engineer all of the Atari 2600 games that she couldn't afford, including Space Invaders. So Rebecca was this young genius who was like 15 or 16 years old, reverse engineering Atari 2600 games, and no one knew at the time, but the Space Invaders game that she was practicing on at home was a ribbon cable sticking out of her Apple II computer, and she got really, really good at it.
That's mind-blowing. What a, like you say, what a genius.
Like, nobody even knew how to do that at this time.
Wow.
You know, like, she's on like forums where they like share like the anarchist cookbook and like, you know, and like bomb codes and shit. Like, she had no idea what she was into, you know, but she loved it.
It just seems such a beautiful, like, self-thought
person. Yeah, like amazing.
Okay, so
she had a friend named Tom Wickier, and luckily he had every single cartridge Atari ever made for the 2600. He had parents who had money, and he would let her borrow them so then she could copy them and reverse engineer them. And together they played a game called Slot Racers and Space Invaders all the time, but he could never beat her. And that was like his goal. He was like, I'm gonna beat you, but he could not do it. So it was Tom that first heard of the Space Invaders tournament. And Rebecca wouldn't have entered if not for his convincing, because kind of due to that low self-esteem that she got from her parents, she truly didn't think she was good enough. She did not think she could win. So despite her protests, he dragged her to the Topanga Canyon Mall sometime in July of 1980, where the LA regionals were being held. So they arrived and there were like 40,000 other kids there, and Rebecca paid $1 to get a ticket to stand in line with all these other people in a line that might seem like it's going to take an eternity, but luckily players were getting eliminated fast, left and right, for two reasons. Firstly, the game was being played on difficulty B, which less skilled players weren't prepared for. It wasn't like an option that everyone could pick at arcades necessarily, but because she had the game, she was able to sort of do that. It was really fast. And no one at Atari ever lasted on difficulty B past like 2 to 3 minutes. And so they didn't think anybody could really last that long anyway. So every kid that was coming up there to compete was getting like knocked out. Secondly, you had to compete with only one shot fire. The game was programmed with like a secret double shot, which was accessed only if you held down the reset button while booting up the game, and it would give you this like double shot thing. But they were told not to do it. And some players though, they still cheated and they were trying to do it, but they got caught. And if they got caught, they were booted immediately. So this game was, this line was actually moving pretty fast and the game was eliminating people pretty quick. It didn't matter how long they stood in the line. If they cheated, they're out.
Okay. Okay. This is getting spicy.
Yeah. Right. Like I like love thinking like this kid's like, oh, I'm gonna get the double shot, you know? So Rebecca finally got inside of the auditorium that they were doing this at, and she approached the kiosk and an Atari tournament guy told her the rules and she started the game. An hour later, she's playing for an hour. These kids weren't lasting past like 2-3 minutes. An hour later, Miss Becky is slaying aliens left and right, totally casual, and recalling how bored she was. She said she was like talking to the judge, being like, how's the weather? And just like playing with and it was like a joystick, you know, like this. So hundreds of kids were getting eliminated during her run, but here she was just blowing past Atari's expectations. It was eye-opening to developers and designers because this was truly the first time maybe ever in video game history that top-level play was really being appreciated.
Mm-hmm. I see this scene in a movie where like, you know, it's like a time lapse and the people are like gathering around her, like slowly, surely. Have you seen this? Oh, go check out her. And then like the crowd comes up and people from different level in the shopping malls are watching. Yes. You
know? Yeah, they're up top being like, is she still playing that?
Yeah. Like someone at the coffee shop is making coffee and like checking on the update. Well, like, you know.
Totally.
This is the moment.
It's crazy. She's going for like over an hour. And finally, you know, the waves are going wave after wave of these things. And she finally gets descended upon by the aliens and they gobble her up. And she asks the judge, she's like, what was my score? And to note, Space Invaders' high score counter only went to 10,000. So every time you hit 10,000, it like reset back to one. So the judge was standing there to count how many times that you would recount that. So she didn't know because she was in a zone how many times she had reset that 10,000. So she had no idea, you know, what her score was. And he looks at her and he goes, you got like 83,000. And she replied, is that good? But inexplicably, he just runs off without saying anything else to her. And used to kind of being ignored as a kid, she kind of thought to herself, well, I guess that's it. And she starts to leave. She wanders off. But then three Atari people stop her before she leaves. And they're like, hey, can we have a word with you? And they tell her that her high score was more than double what any other player had achieved that day. And it was so high that they asked if they could. Yeah, I know. It was so high that they asked if they could wait on posting her leaderboard to the front of the line. Because when you came into the front, it said like what the high score is that you had to beat. And they're like, hey, can we hold off on posting your high score? Because we're afraid that all these other kids are going to turn around and leave. And you know, Atari was making that $1 entry fee. So they're like,
we didn't talk about that, but that's crazy. Like $1.40. That's how they're paying for the whole marketing thing. Oh my God. Okay. That's so cool. And I assume she said, yeah, sure.
Yeah. So she's like, okay, I don't care. So they were like, great. So she was excited, but she still wasn't convinced that she was going to win. So Becky sat and waited for the tournament to conclude. She watched elimination after elimination until the very end when she faced some heat from this kid who was still playing even after the doors closed. So she was like, oh, here it goes. I'm going to lose. He's going to win. But when he finally fell, his score was only half of hers. So the people of Atari named Rebecca Heineman a Los Angeles regional winner. And Atari said they'd be contacting her about the finals in New York City in the months to come. So she filled out some information and she went home and she had a difficult teenage life. So there were other more pressing things kind of on her mind. So she says she kind of forgot about it altogether until one day a letter appeared in the mail with a plane ticket. One plane ticket.
That's so random. Oh my God. How did we live back then? That's crazy.
Atari was just sending a plane ticket to a 16-year-old kid without an additional one for her parents or for a guardian or anything or any permission. And they're just like, come to New York.
Yeah. This is not weird at all. Here's your ticket. We didn't talk about you once before, but
yeah. So for the four other finalists, you know, this wasn't an issue. They all had parents who could afford to buy their own airfare. And they could accompany their kids to New York City. They all had parents who could go, but Rebecca Heineman didn't have that luxury. And although recently she'd moved back in with her mom, she was still mostly estranged from her family. And she says that even if she had invited her parents, they wouldn't have come. So she she packed a suitcase and she flew by herself at 16 years old to one of the biggest cities in the world, which she recalls with both exciting and terrifying because it was her first time out of California. So here she is, she boards a 747 and she gets a seat on the upper deck because they used to have these like, you used to walk upstairs and you go in like this nicer, like upper class kind of thing. So she gets in premium class and then they fly her to New York City where they picked her up in a limousine and they took her to a fancy pants hotel called the Berkshire Place Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. And she opened up the door to her hotel room where she was met with the exact opposite of what she had at home. She had a comfortable bed, a large color television, and a brand new Atari 2600 all set up and ready to go with a complete selection of their game cartridges.
Land Center Hotel.
Right?
That's all I can think of. Yay! Every hotel should have a gaming console.
Totally. I would totally agree with that.
Yep.
And like a true gamer, she retrieved her trusty joystick from her suitcase and plugged it in for practice. So she brought her own joystick from home.
Of course.
Which I love. You know?
Yeah. Even then.
Even then, the first champ brought her own shit. She's like, no.
Yep.
I'm not using yours. This is mine.
That's why she is a champ.
That's damn right. So Atari scheduled some cool activities for the finalists and their families, including a tour of New York City and a visit to the UN. And they even took them to like a dinner at a fancy Italian restaurant. And when Becky met the other four players, sadly, they weren't really that great to her. She recalls being made fun of for not having her parents with her since she was the only kid who traveled alone. And she made half-assed excuses like, oh, they couldn't come or they were busy or whatever. But the kids were onto her and they knew something was going on and they weren't very cool about it, but it just fueled her. So she went back to her hotel room and she practiced. And that next morning, prior to the 10 a.m. finals, Atari took the five players to breakfast. And Rebecca remembers the player from Chicago, Steve Marmel, in a shirt that, quote, looked like a race car driver.
covered
in logos and sponsorships from local video and tech stores. And he was bragging to all the fellow contestants that if he won, he was going to be famous and he had commercials and brand deals lined up and he was going to be on television. And she remembers him just being like all blustery and holier than thou and just assuming he was going to win. So she was like, you know, because she's like a nerdy computer programmer,
you know,
and he's all like, I'm going to be famous.
That's the villain in the movie we're talking about. This is the villain.
Steve.
Yeah.
Steve from Chicago. So Atari at the time had recently been acquired by Warner. So the players were taken to the Time Warner building, which is now known as 30 Rock. They took an elevator up to the fourth floor where they entered a really small room. So different from the photo that we see online of the Space Invaders Championship of the New York Regionals, this room was only a few hundred square feet and set up along one of the walls were five TVs and five Ataris. And behind that were a bunch of folding chairs with the press. And they had ABC, NBC, the New York Times, the AP, Time Magazine, Newsweek. And remember for Atari, you know, this was a marketing event. So they invited everyone, like all the press. The five players went to their seats, their little hotel chairs, and took their positions. And the host, which is like the first esports host, I guess, gets up and says, welcome to the first annual Atari 2600 Space Invaders Tournament. Which is ambitious because it was not annual.
Like a new already. It's the first one of all time. They're like, this is happening every year because we made so much money from that one
100,000 people
registration.
Yeah. And so the host introduces the five players to the press and relays the rules. The rules were last man standing. Whoever lasts the longest wins.
So it's all at the same time.
All the same time. So they're all sitting there. All five players. They all sit in the row and they all are pressing down their reset button, waiting for the host to say go. And then they all released their fingers and the game began.
Okay.
So Rebecca remembers the very beginning of the tournament. She remembers that really clearly, where the sounds for the first couple minutes were totally in sync because the game like had its like four tone sort of sound like going to it. Like the soundtrack wasn't, you know, wasn't much. So it had like the same like, like whatever.
For everyone.
And
okay.
And it was kind of the same. It's not like they had headsets.
Yeah.
Like you could hear like the people next to you.
Isn't that crazy? The whole thing is surreal. It's amazing.
Yeah. And so like, it's like, so she's playing and, but after a couple minutes go by, she describes that the sound kind of became more like an arcade as the rhythm of each player's board was changing. 20 minutes into the game, the aliens took out Chicago Steve Marmel.
Oh!
Race car villain sponsor kid, out. And she remembers kind of snickering, like laughing, being like, ha-ha. And she goes, karma.
This is not a movie. Why has it been? This is a movie. This is perfect.
But I said, I totally said, I was reading this to my husband. I kept going, and then, you know, I'm walking in and he's like, you know. I'm like, I see this as a film.
Yes.
After that, after Steve got eliminated, she went into what she describes as the zone. 1 hour and 45 minutes later, the four remaining players were still at it. And remember, this wasn't exactly ergonomic. They're all like sitting in like crappy hotel chairs in front of like old school television sets with terrible graphics by today's standards. Their retina is probably burning out of their eyeballs, you know, and like these blocky joysticks in their hands for an hour and 45 minutes. And according to Rebecca, ABC and NBC were actually running commentary for the first 30 minutes or so, which means they were effectively the first esports commentators. Like, I don't know who these people were. I have not yet been able to like dig deep enough to find out who they were, but one day I will find out. So they were like doing a play-by-play, but it didn't really last long. They didn't know much about the players and they couldn't really speak to the game's like strategy. So after a while, they just stopped. They just gave up because the kids were still playing. And they like thought
those
for
spectators sure. Are like, okay, this experiment is over. Let's just sit and wait now.
That's the thing, is it was just like the press and like Atari didn't anticipate the finals to last as long as it did. And these kids showed like no sign of slowing. And apparently some members of the press were like starting to feel the effects of their morning coffee and they had to go to the bathroom, but they felt held captive, worried that if they were going to go leave, that they'd miss one of the other players dropping out. So they're all like standing there waiting, like having to go to the bathroom. Others got bored. Some had like afternoon appointments they had to get to. They're like, look, we did not block this time out. So under pressure from the press, Atari changed the rules of the tournament on the fly to a score-based format. They're just like, okay, in just under 2 hours, Rebecca recalls the tournament host getting up in front of the press and says, and so concludes the Atari National Space Invaders Championship. The judges are going to tabulate the scores. But like four contestants were still playing because they thought it was last man standing. So Rebecca, eyes like still glued to the screen, yells out, does this mean we can stop playing? And when she heard the confirmation, she recalls reaching over and yanking out the cartridge from the system and just going, that's it, I'm done with this game.
No way! What? The whole thing is so unreal. I would have been so pissed. This is the worst. This is so random.
Oh, first tournament.
God, I'm so pissed. Okay. Who does that?
Rebecca said there was no applause from the press or the audience. It was more like a sigh of relief. Like everyone's like, oh, thank God, this is over. So can you imagine a tournament ending like that? Like,
I'd be so mad. Can you imagine anything? Like all of a sudden the F1 racing car is like taking too long or something. I don't know. Like, I don't know. This is so dumb.
They're just like, we're bored. We have to end it, you know? So all five teenage players were then asked to stand in a row in front of their stations, awaiting the score tabulation and the placements. Fifth place was, of course, our early sponsorship race car logo, you know, shirt hero, Steve Armel of Chicago. Fourth place went to Robert Merrick of Texas. Third place went to the regionals high score winner and the favorite going into the finals, Frank Tedrow Jr. Yep, the 14-year-old. Okay. And now they announced the second place winner. And that was Hen Ming from San Francisco, which meant that Rebecca Hindman, with 165,200 points, won first place and became the first video game champion of all time in the world, globally, anywhere.
After never, rage quitting.
After like being like, I'm not playing this game anymore. And never in her wildest dreams did she ever think she was going to win or even be good at anything, honestly. So she's just sitting there in shock. And the tournament host like comes up to her and they're like, how do you feel? And
no family, you know, no one.
Like how, no, there was no one there for her. Like everybody else had like, not an entourage, but had a family there and she had no one. So she's just like, and you know, cameras are on her and like, you know, people are taking photographs and she's just, and so they ask her like, how did you feel? How did you prepare? There were no like technical questions about the mechanics or the gameplay. But Rebecca recalled it being more on par with like a sporting event, like winning the Super Bowl. She remembers saying, well, my arm hurts and I could use a sandwich.
Use a sandwich.
My arm hurts.
Can I get a little Sammy, please? Like, what did she win?
Well, I will tell you. So first, to recount her strategy, later she does like talk about this in interviews with like video game magazines and stuff, but she recounted her strategy for the game was to just zone out and rely on muscle memory. And as a young genius, she was able to identify the game's pattern by taking note of which alien shot first. Whichever alien shot first determined the pattern of the entire game. So knowing this allowed her to figure out which pattern she needed to shoot the aliens in order to survive the wave and get the points for shooting the bonus UFO that showed up. She wasn't doing this for the points, by the way. The UFO part was simply a part of her pattern. She knew she had to like shoot 2-2-2-2-2 and then shoot Rose. And at the very end, after she clears the screen, a UFO would come. She would park her spaceship to one spot and shoot a bullet before the UFO even appeared. She knew where it was going to appear. Okay. So she'd shoot it and like get the extra points and then start her pattern all over again. That's probably what cinched her the win, because she didn't need to get the UFO points. She just needed to like, you know, go as long as possible, because originally that was the rules of the game. Whoever lasted the longest. So by hitting the UFO purely to stay in a rhythm of her pattern was probably the reason that she cinched the win. So she recalls moping because she wanted to win second place, because the second place prize was an Atari 800, which is a young programmer she could have really used. As the winner, she got an Asteroids stand-up arcade cabinet, which would not fit in her bedroom. So she asked Atari if they could exchange it for a Missile Command tabletop game, like a cocktail one, you know, and they accommodated her, and 4 to 5 months they delivered it. And she also got a blue t-shirt with her last name, Hindman, and the city Los Angeles, and a little yellow stuffed space invader.
That's crazy. Flying her out there so she can be like a cabinet, like, you know, or just like a tiny shirt. Oh yeah.
Yeah. And a stuffed animal. But she said both the shirt, man. She still has the cabinet, but both the shirt and the toy have disintegrated.
She said
her kid actually ate the stuffed space invader, like just pulled it apart and stuff, and the shirt just like fell apart. So the after party that they had was in like an adjoining room, and it had food and mingling, where she was approached to write an article for Electronics Games Magazine, because she was like the first global and only video game champion ever. She wrote an article about how to beat the games. And to supplement her income, Becky started working at the local arcade as a video game repair woman. And any game that was broken down, she fixed. And in doing so, she got a play for free and became good at pretty much all of them. She competed a few more times, won some regional championships for Tempest, a Defender, and also played in Centipede. But a year later, after her win, Avalon Hill Game Company contacted Electric Games Magazine and asked if they knew anyone who knew anything about the Atari 2600, so they suggested Becky, who was, of course, continuing to reverse engineer the Atari cartridge codes. She was only 17 years old, so she lied about her age and moved across the country to take a job with them as a computer programmer, where she created the base code for several of their software projects, including her very own first game called London Blitz. Her second job led her back to California for another developer called Boon Corporation, where she programmed the games Chuck Norris Super Kicks and Robin Hood.
That is so cool that she stayed in gaming.
Yes.
I love it.
She definitely stayed in gaming. It ended up expanding her knowledge of programming for systems like the Commodore 64, which was my first system, the VIC-20 and IBM PCs. In 1983, Boon went under, as did the entire video game industry, with shitty games that were just being shipped, and the ill-fated E.T. game, which rushed to market at the same time as the film schedule, and it killed all the momentum of the industry, becoming what we now call the great video game crash of 1983.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
All of this history kind of got swept up with that crash. But refusing to give up entirely, Rebecca got together with three friends, Brian Fargo, James Patel, and Tori Worrell, and the four founded Interplay. And Becky was the lead programmer and created and worked on iconic titles such as Bard's Tale 1, 2, and 3, Dragon Wars, and Wolfenstein 3D for the Mac OS and 3DO ports. Interplay was super successful and had 500 employees at one time. But by 95, Becky left to co-found Logicware and serve as the CTO and lead programmer who oversaw much of the company's porting, including Jazz Jackrabbit 2 and the canceled Mac OS port for Half-Life. In the late 90s and 2000s, Rebecca consulted and provided various tasks for EA, Ubisoft, Bloomberg, Amazon, XPlay, PlayStation, and more. While at Amazon, Becky was also named the transgender chair for the LGBTQ plus group known as Glamazon. She's a vocal LGBTQ advocate and has served as a board member for GLAAD. Today, she has her own company called Old Skull that she founded with her wife, Janelle Jacquet, and a few friends. And something to note, Rebecca was a hacker at heart, you know? And Fuzz, she left her signature as Easter eggs in her games to prove that she was the one who actually made them, so no one could shaft her for her credit down the line. So in many of these old text adventure games, if you typed in her nickname, which was Burger, because she liked to put hamburgers in her desk and store them for later. So her friends called her Burger.
Yeah.
If you type in Burger, it would trigger a mechanic that would say varying degrees of, you have spoken the most ruthless and unholy of names, prepare to die. And your character would be instantly murdered. And this was apparently found in Bard's Tale 1, 2, and 3, as well as Dragon Wars, and anything where she was the primary. She put that signature to stake her claim, which is fucking baller.
It's so cool. I think Easter eggs are pretty amazing. And with the internet now, knowing the Easter eggs comes out so fast, it's not the same anymore.
No.
It's really not the same. So that's pretty cool.
Cool, especially because how would you find that? You know, you kind of just had to know. So people would be like, you didn't design on that game. She's like, oh yeah, type in Burger right here and tell me what happens. She just knew. So anyway, that is the story of Rebecca Burger Becky Heideman, the very first global esports champion. You can find her on social media at Burger Becky.
Because of video game.
Yes. Because Becky of video games.
Found a life or a career or a passion. I don't know. It changed her whole thing.
Exactly. Because of video games, Becky became the first global esports champion. I mean, and not only that, she's a transgender woman. She changed the way, she alone changes the way that we should look at gaming and esports, just to know how it began and how it started and how inclusive it can and should be.
Mm-hmm. And how you need to define the rules of our tournaments before it comes out. That's what I'm thinking about right now still. Oh my God, I can't believe they would do that.
No, they're we just got to change it. Never mind, score-based.
Yeah. Never mind, we're idiots. Now it's score-based. We didn't think about all the variables.
Our bad.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's amazing.
It's a pretty cool story.
Awesome.
And like founding Interplay is like a big deal. Like, you know, most game designers out there, if you ask them, like, they will talk about Interplay and they'll talk about this time period of gaming specifically that she was a huge part of, you know? She was a big part of like the California hacker culture. You know, she knew a lot of those like big hackers, like Captain Crunch, like those guys that like got in trouble. Like, she knew them. She knew who they were. And she'll talk about her hacking past. Like, if you watch interviews with her, and she's like, you can tell she's done some shady shit. She's not going to like, she goes, anything that I did dies with me. Like, she's never going to talk. She did
that
some
stuff.
That
is so cool. That's one thing, right? You wish you could all do that. Even the movies can't portray hacking well. Like, no one really gets it, right?
Except nobody can.
Hackers. That's so cool. What a great story.
Oh, I'm so glad you liked it.
Fun.
It was fun to like read about her, you know?
Couldn't have been the better first story for this. I'm so happy we picked. Well, you knew about it, first of all, and we picked this. This was perfect. So this is it. This was our first episode. I'm nervous to hear your comments. Are you
so
nervous?
I'm so nervous. I'm so nervous. I hope I did Becky justice because like it is such a cool story. And Atari, like, what are you doing? That was so like amazing. I really hope you guys like the story. Please let us know what you guys think by leaving a review on any of the podcast platforms. And remember, if you have a story that you want to share about how video games affected your life, you can send us an email at thevideogamediaries.com.
Really excited to read all of your stuff. Remember, this podcast is now going to be every Tuesday. So make sure to remember on Tuesday when you wake up, check out your favorite podcast platform and or YouTube if you want to see the video of it of us. So either or, whatever you prefer, and we'll be in your ears to tell you about a new gaming stories every week.
Sounds great. See you guys next week.
See you guys.